Hello and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capitol Week, where we explore and analyze who's been making news at the Iowa State Capitol, including the governor and state lawmakers, and what the news is that they've been making. I'm Dennis Hart, and I'm joined, as always, by Laura Bellin of the must-read political blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, hello again. It is good to be with you again.
Hi, nice to be with you, Dennis.
Well, as we talked just before this broadcast began, the governor was busy last week. Governor Reynolds signing into law bills that had been passed earlier by the state legislature. Among them, the bill that defined concepts that cannot be used in diversity training. Now, this has several layers, and you're going to be ready. I know you're ready to unpack all of them. What does this mean?
Yes. First, I just want to make clear that the governor has 30 days after the legislative session ends to sign all the bills. So she should be signing anything that she hasn't already signed. She should be either signing or vetoing in the next week or so. So we'll have plenty to talk about next week. But this bill, this is the one that originally it was called the Divisive Concepts Bill. They changed the wording toward the end of the session to specific defined concepts. And it's really tricky because some people will tell you, well, this isn't going to have any effect because diversity training that local governments and school districts and universities are doing, they don't do any of these prohibited things. The race or sex scapegoating, race or sex stereotyping, that's just not part of any standard diversity training. But some of the specific defined concepts in this bill are a little more vague. So one of them is that any individual should feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress on account of that individual's race or sex. Well, we know that conversations about racism and diversity can make people uncomfortable. So there's a concern that if somebody feels uncomfortable, they may assume that that means that this training was in violation of the law. A couple that are problematic in the words of, in the views of a lot of educators are, you can't teach that the United States or the state of Iowa are fundamentally or systemically racist or sexist, and you can't have any other form of race or sex stereotyping. And, you know, that's a fairly subjective concept. I mean, some people would say that when it was written into the U.S. Constitution that slaves would count as three-fifths of a person for the census count purposes, I mean, that is kind of a systemically racist way of organizing things. And the fact that women couldn't vote for more than 100 years of our country's history, again, you know, a systemically sexist thing that was built into our founding documents. So it's a little bit hard to see, you know, that there are clauses in the bill that say, well, this doesn't prevent teaching about racism or including things in a curriculum materials as part of a broader coursework. But some people are worried that this bill is going to have a chilling effect, that people just won't even want to broach these subjects because they won't want to be have to be concerned that somebody's going to go complain to the administration about it.
The governor did say that the new law works against the teaching of critical race theory. That's that theory that's really in the news these days that examines how the legacy of slavery continues to influence American society. So she seems to think it really is going to tamp down on teaching that.
Well, and it's funny because the bill doesn't mention critical race theory. And I have talked to a number of educators about this. I am confident that there are no primary or secondary schools in the state of Iowa that are teaching critical race theory. In fact, most undergraduates even are not studying it. It's really a concept that's more of higher level academic courses and graduate level coursework. And it has been influential in the academic world, but it's just not part of real life. So this is a good example. When I used to study communications theory, when I was in graduate school, they talk about the media having an agenda setting role. And this is a good example because Fox News and some of the conservative media have been talking a lot about critical race theory. And so that is getting more people concerned about critical race theory, even though it doesn't actually exist in course materials. And there have been a lot of laws introduced in more than a dozen states now, signed into law in some of those states, that would ban in some form this kind of teaching in schools when it's just not happening.
Governor also signed several budget bills into law last week. One of them includes an additional $21 million for corrections budget, including an extra $3 million for the Anamosa State Penitentiary. This, of course, in reaction to that terrible incident of months ago in which a couple of employees at Anamosa were gunned down inside the prison. So this was essentially, Democrats had asked for this, the Republicans agreed.
Yes, well, the Democrats wanted even a larger increase in the corrections budget, but this was a more, toward the end of the session, this was a big area disagreement between the House and the Senate Republicans. The House Republicans wanted this increase in the corrections budget, and the Senate Republicans wanted a much smaller increase. So they haggled over that, and this was one of the concessions that the House Republicans got in those negotiations. They agreed to a lot of things, as we've discussed in previous weeks. They agreed to a lot of the tax code changes, property tax changes that the Senate Republicans were looking for, but this was one thing among several that the Senate Republicans gave up in exchange. And I mean, Democrats will tell you that this still isn't enough to make up for the cuts in correction staffing that have happened over the last 10 or 12 years, but it will go part of the way toward solving some of the problems. And specifically that Anamosa prison, there was a terrible murder of two staff members there in March, but there have been other incidents where staff members have been assaulted. And there was actually an Iowa OSHA report well before those murders happened that said that that faulted the prison, that they said they didn't have a good communication system. They didn't have the staffing set up so that people could assist each other in an emergency. And that just wasn't acted on until after this terrible tragedy.
You reported last week on Bleeding Heartland in another story that a revised lawsuit is challenging what some are calling Iowa's newest voter suppression law, the law that Governor Reynolds signed in to effect after the legislature passed a number of restrictions for future elections. So how is this going to potentially impact the law, and what are the changes?
Well, the big changes were in that law the governor signed in March that we've talked about before, that shortened the early voting period, shortened election day voting, gave people less time to mail ballots back, required absentee ballots to be returned by election day rather than arriving after election day if there's a postmark, and limits on who can help hand deliver somebody's ballot. So that was the big law that people are calling the voter suppression law. The bill that the governor just signed last week was supposed to be, it was described as technical election bill. And these changes were introduced on the very last day of the legislative session. And one of the changes relates to who can return the absentee ballot. So it's still very restrictive. For most voters, it can be the voter themselves, somebody living in the household, a family member, or somebody who is a caretaker. Now, if you are blind or physically disabled, that's what this new law says. Specifically for blind or physically disabled people, they can also designate somebody to one person to return their ballot, but it can't be anybody. It can't be a candidate. It can't be anybody working for their company where they work. It can't be anyone working for a labor union that they belong to. And so it's, again, fairly restrictive. And as I'm reading this law, if I'm not blind or physically disabled, I live alone, I don't have family nearby, I don't think there's anybody I can ask to return my ballot. So that could be a problem for people who, you know, they just kind of leave it late. They don't want to put it in the mail because they're worried it won't arrive in time. They're going to have to go themselves. And if they don't have a car or don't have transportation or can't get time off work, that could be a problem. So that was one of the big changes in that the bill that the governor signed last week. The other one relates to satellite voting. So this is something, it is an issue in bigger counties, Story County being one of them, where county auditors, in addition to having the early in-person voting at the county auditor's office, they often will set up other early voting sites around the county. It might be in places like public libraries, community centers, usually in convenient locations where a lot of people gather. And again, it's used primarily in the larger counties of Iowa. The small rural counties don't have a lot of satellite voting. So the bill in March said that county auditors could no longer independently schedule their own satellite voting sites just based on what they think will work well or what they think will be convenient. You can only do satellite voting if voters petition for a site. Now, this new bill gives the county auditor four reasons for rejecting an otherwise valid petition for an early voting site. So that's problematic because, for instance, now in Scott County, which is the third largest in Iowa, it contains the Quad Cities, the Iowa side of the Quad Cities, they now have a Republican county auditor. So if voters there petition for an early voting location in some place like a library or a city hall where they've had it in the past, the auditor could say, well, we just can't staff that, and could turn that down. Now, I don't anticipate in places like Story County, Polk County, Dubuque County, Linn County. I don't anticipate that the auditors will be rejecting a lot of petitions for satellite voting because they like the satellite voting. It means shorter lines down at the central election office, and it helps them manage their workflow a little bit better. So I don't anticipate in most places auditors turning down those voting sites, but it does create an opportunity for people to have a hard time voting early in person.
Laura, it's one thing to file a lawsuit against a law. It's another thing to have success with that lawsuit. What are the people you talk with, and you talk with a lot of folks, what do they think the odds are on getting some of this law tossed out?
Well, and it's interesting because when I talked to people in March, the part that people thought was the most problematic was this limit on who can return your absentee ballot, and specifically with respect to people with disabilities. And so I think that's why they fixed that portion of the law, and they created another option for people who are blind or have a physical disability. But of course, there could be lots of people who have trouble returning a ballot, again, who don't drive, can't drive, don't have a car, a caregiver with young children who finds it hard to get out. So, I mean, I just don't know. The thing about this law is there are many, many provisions that make it slightly harder to vote, and no one of them makes it impossible for someone to vote. And so it's possible that this Iowa Supreme Court, because eventually this will get to the Iowa Supreme Court. Right now it's in the Polk County District Court, but eventually the Iowa Supreme Court may look at this and say, well, there, you know, it's hard to see that any Iowan would be completely blocked from voting. And in general, in the last 50 years of case law around the country, the limits on absentee voting that have been allowed are pretty significant because the right to cast an absentee ballot has not been held to be as sacrosanct as the right to vote generally. So I think it's possible that the justices could look at this and say, well, everyone always has the option to vote on election day, so these limits on early voting really aren't that big a deal. Now, I mean, people who work in election administration will tell you a lot of people can't vote on election day. Things come up. They're called out of town for work. Maybe somebody got sick. Maybe they had a family emergency. And so really, when you prevent somebody from conveniently casting an early ballot, you could be disenfranchising that person. But I could really see this going either way, because I think that the court isn't going to look at any one of these things and say, well, that is just way too restrictive.
Okay, we will wait and see, and we'll be reporting on that on Capitol Week, of course. Governor made more news last week when she said that when state lawmakers return to the Capitol, as they must, for a special session later this summer, she expects their primary goal to be redistricting rather than using that extra time to pass any lingering policy bills. And we know the coronavirus delayed census data, so that means lawmakers have to come back and create some new district maps. What do we think about this from what you're hearing again? Will lawmakers restrict themselves to redistricting, or are there some other things, perhaps some gubernatorially wanted other things that could creep in?
Well, last week, the Iowa Capitol Press Association did some legislative forums with the House Speaker. Pat Grassley did one. The House Democratic leaders and the Senate Democratic leaders, the Senate Majority Leader refused to participate. But this was, of course, a question was asked of the House Speaker. And he didn't commit to saying if they do a special session, it will only be about redistricting. He said he thought it would primarily be about redistricting. I should add that it's not 100% guaranteed that there will be a special session about redistricting. I do think that will happen, but we don't know exactly when the census numbers will come in. We think that will be by mid-August. We don't know how long the Legislative Services Agency will spend trying to make a map. If they come up with some kind of a map within a week or two, then certainly legislators would come back before September 15th and vote on that. But the Constitution says the legislature has to adopt new maps by September 1st, and those have to be signed into law by September 15th. And if the September 15th deadline isn't met, then the Iowa Supreme Court takes over the process. So really, the court doesn't have to, I mean, that the legislature, if everything happens is so delayed that there's no map by September 15th, the Iowa Supreme Court could just have the map drawn up themselves. Now, they could allow the legislators to vote on it, but we don't know that they definitely will. The congressional map, I would say definitely at some point, it's very likely the legislature would come back and vote on a congressional map. But again, it's not guaranteed, and a lot depends on the timing of when the census data comes in. But I do expect that mostly they'll be working on redistricting, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Senate and House leaders try to slip in one or more of the bills that they couldn't get through during the regular session.
How often has the Supreme Court had to do this in Iowa?
Never. We've only had this system since 1980. And I mean, a law professor was explaining to me that the reason why they wrote the Constitution this way back in the 1850s was they didn't want incumbents in the legislature to sit around and say, well, we'd prefer not to draw new maps. We like the districts the way they are. And they wanted there to be a fail-safe in case the legislature just dragged its feet and refused to do redistricting. So that's why they put this deadline in there. But we've never had a situation where the census data wasn't available to states until so late in the process. And so it's never happened. And the current redistricting setup that we have with the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency drawing a map that the legislature then votes on, that's only been in place since the 1980-81 redistricting round. So nothing like this has ever happened. I mean, in the last round in 2011, Branstad had signed the new maps into law by, I think, April 19th. I looked it up a little while ago. So it all happened very quickly in past cycles.
It is 16 minutes after the hour, and you are Zooming with us through KHOI Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bell, and we are happy you are riding along with us. And we need to remind you that the views and opinions being expressed here do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI or its staff. They are ours, but I think you knew that. The governor made more news last week when she said she wanted an investigation into what happened when those 19 unaccompanied children were transported on that overnight flight from California through Des Moines in April, then taken on buses somewhere out of state. This became a mystery. There were denials by the federal government, and now the governor really wants to jump in with an investigation. Let's kind of download that one.
Well, this is a very strange story, and I really don't know what to make of it. I haven't been investigating it thoroughly, but I know that Andrea Mesa-Hurry from the Des Moines Register has really been all over the story. I started seeing in early May, people were commenting on the flight that happened from Long Beach, California. Landed in the charter flight, landed in the Des Moines airport. And I talked to somebody whose son is a plane spotter. And she said, oh yeah, he was at the airport that night because anytime there's an unusual plane, he's out there taking pictures. And he thought it was very strange. And people were coming off the plane from the back, which isn't usually what happens. And it was all very mysterious. And the various government agencies were denying to the Des Moines Register and other media outlets that this flight even occurred. So I mean, it seems that these were unaccompanied minors. There have been some media reports that they were being united with family members, extended family somewhere, but I haven't really seen that confirmed. And I do find it odd that whenever a government agency lies about having chartered a flight, I mean, I just find that strange. So, you know, the governor, the Republican Party generally is really talking up the crisis at the border and the Biden administration's policies at the border. And so I think this is part of a broader Republican messaging strategy. So I think that is partly why the governor is calling for this investigation. I mean, the governor said that they didn't want any of unaccompanied migrant children brought to Iowa. And as far as I can tell, none of the children on that flight were settled in Iowa or relocated to Iowa or families in Iowa. So it's not really clear why the governor's permission would be needed. I mean, you don't need to ask the governor in order to charter a plane to land at the Des Moines airport. So I'm not really sure on that side of it, you know, what the governor's legal position is on, you know, demanding this investigation. But I do think that there are a lot of unanswered questions about the flight, and I'm sure that the Des Moines Register isn't the only news organization looking into it.
Yeah, I don't think this one's going to go away, and we'll be on this one for weeks, perhaps, or months. Here's another one that doesn't go away. A word last week, new development, that former State Department of Human Resources Director Jerry Foxhoven suing Governor Reynolds, claiming that she and her staff fired him in a big story 2 years ago for what he said was questioning the legality of paying one of her aides with federal Medicaid money. Now, Reynolds, the governor said later, that Foxhoven's dismissal was partly related to a scandal, an ongoing scandal over patient deaths at the Glenwood Resource Center, a truly, apparently troubled site in Iowa. cares for Iowans with severe disabilities. So Fox Hoven is now suing the governor. Where do you think this one goes, and how does this resolve itself down the road?
Well, these lawsuits against the state, these wrongful termination suits, can take years. So I don't anticipate that this one will be heard anytime soon. There's a different wrongful termination suit that the former communications director of the Iowa Department of Public Health filed last year. And that one, I think, is slated to be heard in the summer of 2022. So that one might be heard before the election. This Jerry Foxhoven story, it really came out of the blue for people in June, almost exactly 2 years ago now, when he resigned abruptly. He then said he was forced to resign. And nobody really knew why. The governor's office just said that they had a lot of reasons. They didn't. It was more than 6 months later that they mentioned the problems at Glenwood. They said, well, there were several factors and we just are going in a different direction. And later in the summer of 2019, Jerry Foxhoven started talking about this question of his agency had been paying about 2/3 of the salary of the governor's deputy chief of staff. And that was fine while she was doing a lot of work related to Iowa's Medicaid program. But in his telling of the story in early 2019, he mentioned to the governor's chief of staff, you know, that this person is no longer really doing a lot of work for Iowa Medicaid. And so I don't think I can use Medicaid dollars to cover part of her salary anymore. So this was all part of a bigger debate over who's paying the governor's staff salaries. And as it turned out, they just ended up having, after Jerry Foxhoven was forced out, they ended up having the Department of Human Services cover the salary of a different staffer in the governor's office, not this deputy chief of staff. But so, you know, people say, well, aren't the department directors at-will employees and can't they be fired for any reason? And most of the time, that's true. The governor can fire any agency director for any reason, but one of the exceptions to that is the governor can't do that in violation of public policy. And so he's claiming in his lawsuit, he's citing Iowa's whistleblower statute that he says that he was fired because he raised concerns about possibly illegal use of federal funds. And he also claims that he was blocked from using his speech rights, in effect, were blocked. He was blocked from seeking a legal opinion about this. And he claims, I don't know that he has any, it's not clear whether he has any written evidence of this, but he claims that he had told the governor's senior staff he was going to ask the attorney general's office for an opinion on this on June 18th of 2019. And in fact, he was fired on June 17th before he had a chance to ask for that opinion.
Going to be interesting to see if this plays out in next year's gubernatorial election, if this becomes an issue.
Yes, I think certainly, well, one of the lawsuits probably will, and this one may or may not be heard before the election, but I think it will probably be an issue in the campaign regardless.
Yep. There was also word last week, and this seemed strange to maybe more than a few people, that the state of Iowa is no longer letting Iowans view their own vaccination records or those of their children online after concerns that employers might look at them. Now, to clarify, the State Department of Public Health is limiting public access to the website. So what do we make of this?
Well, it's related to, it's funny because the vaccine passports bill that was signed into law a few weeks ago actually didn't say that employers can't require their employees to be vaccinated. That was one of the things that a lot of the anti-vaccine activists didn't like about it. It said that businesses can't require customers or clients to be vaccinated, but it didn't say that they couldn't require employees to be vaccinated. So I don't really know why all of a sudden the Department of Public Health got very worried that people were going to be looking up their employees' records. I mean, it seems like there should be a way to make that secure so that people can check their own families' records. I mean, if you've been vaccinated, as I have, you get a little card, but I imagine that many people misplace that card or lose it. And so it's important to have some convenient way for people to go online and just verify, be able to verify and order another card or some other thing. So I don't know if this is really going to stand. I think there may be some kind of challenge to this because people do need to have access to their own family records.
Going to be interesting to see how this plays out and why it plays out the way it will. Starting this past Saturday, on another issue, Iowans receiving jobless benefits no longer received additional federal benefits because the governor had discontinued the state's participation in that federal program. In an effort, she said, to get unemployed Iowans back to work. The idea being, if you're getting these extra benefits, it's too easy to stay at home rather than applying for a job. How many people are we talking about here, and what's the potential impact?
Well, the Iowa Workforce Development Agency has not been very clear about exactly how many people. It's certainly in the tens of thousands of people. So there's the one program that has the most enrollees, tens of thousands. That was a federal program that was giving people an extra $300 a month. Earlier in the pandemic, the first 4 months of the pandemic, people were getting $600 a week. It expired for a while, and then the Democrats brought it back for $300 a week. So it's not enough for anybody to live on, $300 a week. It is something that a lot of people were finding helpful to get by. I mean, the big question is, is cutting people's unemployment benefit really going to force people to go back to work? And what we see in Iowa is there's a mismatch between where jobs are available and where unemployed people are. And then there are also a lot of people who might not be able to do the available jobs in their communities. Either they might have physical limitations to doing certain kinds of work, or they can't find affordable childcare. And of course, we're in the summer when people's kids are home from school. So that's going to make it even more difficult for people to take a job. So last year, during the period when some of this pandemic-related unemployment expired for a while, there wasn't a huge boom in hiring. I mean, the hiring was continuing at a similar pace to before. So economists are really split on whether this is going to get a lot of people back to work. It may just mean that people who are out of work have less money to spend at their local businesses and to spend on household necessities.
Okay, it's about 27 after the hour. We have about 5 minutes left. You wrote on Bleeding Heartland, and you are always writing day and night on Bleeding Heartland, I am impressed, that Iowa Republicans have abandoned executive branch oversight. Now, that is a serious allegation. Can you explain?
Well, the House and Senate have government oversight committees, and in recent years, those committees have not met very often. The Senate committee has hardly met at all. It will have one or two meetings a year, usually. The House committee is a little bit more active. But what I've noticed is that since Republicans have been in control of both chambers of the legislature, they just haven't had any interest in investigating executive branch conduct. So these committees rarely even invite top agency officials to testify about things. They, in theory, they have subpoena power. They can look into questionable actions by the executive branch, and it's just not happening. So when you consider that we've just had a huge pandemic where more than 6,000 Iowans died, there was not a single oversight committee meeting about any aspect of that pandemic. So nothing about whether the safety inspectors were doing enough to create safe or to enforce safe working conditions at meatpacking plants, nothing about testing and whether testing resources were given to companies that were politically well-connected, nothing about the no-bid contracts, nothing about the questionable use of the federal COVID relief money, either for the workday computer system or for other things like the governor's staff salaries. I mean, there just are any number of things. The unemployment payments that many Iowans had trouble collecting, these pandemic-related unemployment benefits that are now expiring. And so, you know, there are just lots of things these committees could have been doing. And the Senate committee this year held one organizational meeting, and that was it. The House Government Oversight Committee, they had three meetings related to a conservative dental student at the University of Iowa who felt that he was disadvantaged. He was not well treated by faculty because he was conservative. And then they had one meeting, which we talked about in the past week, that was related to the Ames School District's use of a Black Lives Matter curriculum in February. But that was it. So, you know, they're really not looking at anything the governor is doing. They're not looking at anything the executive branch agencies are doing. And I think that's problematic when billions of dollars are coming into the state in COVID relief money. And there certainly is no shortage of things that could be investigated related to the pandemic.
In the couple of minutes that we have left, let's talk about something, again, you wrote on Bleeding Heartland, that both Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst of Iowa had voted with every other U.S. Senate Republican to block debate last week on a bill that would have provided more effective remedies in the payment of wages on the basis of sex. So let's unpack a little bit of that.
So the Paycheck Fairness Act is something that Democrats have been trying to pass since the first term of Barack Obama. And it's something they've been able to get through the House a few times, but it's always been filibustered in the Senate. So the idea is to try to get around the gender gap, where it's been illegal for a long time to pay men and women differently for doing substantially equal jobs. But the Equal Pay Act of 1963 has a lot of limitations, and it's very difficult. Often it's difficult for women to even find out that they're the victims of gender-based wage discrimination. And then it's also difficult for them to file class action suits. So this bill would do a number of things to address that. It would say, like, for instance, that employers couldn't rely on someone's wage history when considering a job applicant. That's something that kind of locks in inequities, because if you were underpaid at your last job and then your future employer asks what your salary was, you could be locked into being underpaid at the next job. So there was only one Republican in the House who voted for this bill in April. And as I mentioned, no Republicans in the Senate voted for it. So it's nowhere close to getting the 60 votes that they would need to overcome a filibuster in the Senate. But it's one of a number of bills, popular ideas that the Senate Democratic leaders are going to be bringing to the floor to force Republicans to actually go through the motions of the filibuster.
All right. Well, we have only about 30 seconds left. I don't know where the time goes. It just flies on this show. What do you expect this week? What might happen? Give us your crystal ball.
The last few bills are going to be signed. So I expect that policing bill, the so-called Back the Blue bill, I expect that to be signed this week. And there are a few other things to be tidied up with the legislative session. We'll have some more things to talk about with the budget next week, I think, as well.
We always do. And what do you have coming up on Bleeding Heartland this week?
Also, some candidate announcements, possibly, in some of the federal races. So we'll be covering that soon.
Laura, get some sleep.
I'll try.
We are just about out of time. You have been listening, and we thank you for doing so, to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. Laura and I will be right back here in this time slot, we promise, next week, with a look at what makes news with the governor and with state lawmakers, and yes, what it means for all of us. Until then, we thank you so very, very much for the privilege of your time. We know you have plenty of other things to do. Thank you, and we hope you have a great week.